Seattle, if Washington State was its own country, it would be one of the largest nuclear powers in the world.
Well, when you find out that a major international nuclear target is that close, even if you don't live in Seattle, you can bet that there's another nuclear problem just down the road, whether you knew about it or not, and likely you don't. And what that does is put you and me and everyone in that uncomfortable, unavoidable seat that we all unfortunately share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we continue our series of update interviews by looking at stopping points on the nuclear fuel chain through the eyes of up-close and personal activists. Nuclear power reactors through the closure of Three Mile Island in Pennsylvania, and what comes next with Three Mile Island Alert's Eric Epstein. Radioactive waste issues at San Onofre with Charles Langley and Nina Babiarz of Public Watchdogs. First Nations fight back to uranium mining and small modular nuclear reactors in northern Saskatchewan with Candace Paul of English River First Nations and the Committee for Future Generations. And nuclear weapons with Carly Brook of Washington State Physicians for Social Responsibility. We'll also have Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness and more honest nuclear information than President Donald Trump shared with the Ukrainian president in that infamous phone call. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, September 24th, 2019, and here's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
The Center for Disease Control, the Environmental Protection Agency, and Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, have all advised people that in case of a nuclear explosion, they should never, never use hair conditioner. If you find yourself outside during a nuclear detonation, the CDC recommends that you seek shelter immediately. Take off contaminated clothing and hop into the shower as soon as possible. You can use shampoo, but don't use that hair conditioner because it can trap radiation in your hair. Right. Like the water infrastructure is still going to be there when the fireball or shockwaves from a blast can topple buildings, reducing a city of the size of Hiroshima or Nagasaki to dust. The warning from the CDC adds, after 48 hours, the exposure rate from a 10-kiloton explosion, that's two-thirds the size of Hiroshima, but they say it's the type that might damage but not destroy a city. Hint, hint, propaganda alert. At that point, it might be safe to venture outside and resume your normal personal care routine. Just ignore all the dead bodies and hope you don't die from radiation poisoning in a month. I can't make this stuff up. And that's why CDC, FEMA, EPA, you are conjoined this week as
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numbnuts of the Week.
Here are this week's featured interviews. We take a look at the problems at four stops on the nuclear fuel chain: uranium mining, reactors, radioactive waste, and nuclear weapons. And we examine what local activists are doing about each. First, we'll start with the good news. After 45 years of operation, the remaining unmelted down reactor at Three Mile Island was finally shut down for good on Friday, September 20th, a full week ahead of schedule and still on time to be a birthday present to me. Nuclear Hot Seat has covered Three Mile Island extensively. This year with specials on the 40th anniversary of the nuclear accident on Nuclear Hot Seat 405 from March 26 and number 407 from April 9. Here, we check in with Eric Epstein, head of Three Mile Island Alert, on what it means for this nuclear reactor to close and what lies ahead.
First of all, congratulations on the closure of Three Mile Island.
Well, thanks, but, you know, this is just one chapter in a long odyssey, and we have a lot of heavy lifting ahead of us. The decommissioning fund is not sufficient. Exelon is requesting to raid the fund to build dry cast storage. In addition to that, TMI-2 may be flipped. There was an announcement this summer that Environmental Solutions may take TMI-2 off the hands of First Energy, which would be interesting. So we may have two plants decommissioned at the same time. I doubt it. I think the decommissioning for TMI-1, which is proposed to be put off till 2075, will affect TMI-2. So although neither plant is generating energy, they're still generating a lot of problems.
How is the closure being received?
Hey, look, Pennsylvania is the only state that hasn't bailed out nukes. I know that they're trying to save Beaver Valley out west, but I don't see any action on that this fall. So, you know, a lot of energy was spent trying to get a bailout bill through. TMI was basically the poster child. It went down. So a lot of steam has been taken out of the nuclear engine. Suffice to say that the reaction was somewhat muted. It was the 40th anniversary of the accident. The bailout legislation was a war. The plant was shut down a week earlier than anticipated on Friday. So I think a lot of folks were exhausted by the battle on both sides of the issue. Nuclear now basically moves to the western part of the state to discuss Beaver Valley. But we're entrenched here. I mean, we have TMI-2. The basement is still too highly radioactive, and I'm very skeptical it can be cleaned up. And Exelon basically wants to raid the decommissioning fund and come back in 2075. Which is about 100 years after the accident at TMI-2. So it's still a very complicated, dirty, unresolved situation. Suffice to say that I think most folks in the community were happy to see it shut down, but just want to move on with their lives.
What's next in terms of the work of TMI Alert?
There's a lot of work ahead. We have testified before the House, and we're working to make sure that Exelon and other plants that shut down their facilities are still responsible for emergency planning, KI distribution, and maintaining the site. So first order of business is TMI-1. Exelon wants to reduce the responsibilities to the fence line. So we'll litigate that. The second order of business is making sure they're not able to raid the decommissioning fund. We were noticed by the NRC that we're still about a year away on that. So Exelon is planning to move waste to dry cask and then charge the ratepayers later. And then the intangible is what happens to TMI-2. It's still not cleaned up. We paid for the defueling. Decommissioning would be quite a challenge. So it's just back to the office. That's what I'm doing today after handling the media. We'll be back in court in October on TMI-1 and likely back in court in November on TMI-2. So while the plant's not operating, we still are.
Are there lessons in this for those of us who are working on other nuclear reactors, either to get them shut down or the next stage, which is dealing with what to do with the radioactive high-level fuel that's left behind?
Yeah, I think the lesson is that the NRC basically is a sham, and so you have to exert pressure through other regulatory bodies. So for us, we work through two other agencies to try and monitor the plant and regulate what they do. One would be the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission. The other is the Susquehanna River Basin Commission, which controls water use. So we recognize that the NRC process is futile. We still litigate. Otherwise, they'll say to us, you know, you weren't actively involved in the issues. So one of the lessons that we learned is that to rally the support of local officials, statewide officials, use the regulatory options that are real. For us, it's the Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission and the Susquehanna River Basin Commission. You know, there was a point I thought the NRC, when we still had the systematic assessment of licensed performance, the SALP, was at least marginally interested, but there's no pretense of interest. You know, it's just the charade. So I know we all have limited resources, limited time, limited money. I would just encourage people to focus and invest on success and ignore what, in my opinion, is a just a useless process, and that process is called the NRC.
Even facing all of these difficulties coming up, did you at least take a few minutes out to celebrate or hoist a beer or do anything to mark the occasion?
Actually, didn't have time because we got notice on the decommissioning schedule for TMI 1 on Friday. So on the same day the plant shut down, we were noticed about the time frame for that. So we actually, I met with the NRC this morning. In addition to that, we have Peach Bottom license extension. So be honest with you, Libby, we haven't. We're fully engaged. I think there'll come an opportunity for us to decompress. Right now, we just don't want to let down our guard and want to continue to apply pressure. It's a full docket. I wish it wasn't. I wish we could say that, yeah, we had time to celebrate, but we're back in the office today talking to you. After I get off the phone, I've got some other calls and meetings to follow up on.
Well, you've done a spectacular job for decades with TMIA, Eric, and all the other activists that are there. So congratulations on at least having one benchmark behind you. It's the best birthday present I could have had because my birthday is next Sunday. And keep us informed as to the coming battles because closure is just the first step.
Right. Thanks so much for having us on.
That was Eric Epstein of Three Mile Island Alert. We will, of course, have links to all the interviewees up on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 431. As you heard, once a nuclear reactor closes, the need for citizen action doesn't end. It just shifts to another aspect of the nuclear problem. What to do with the highly radioactive waste that remains deadly for literally hundreds of thousands of years? Here in Southern California, we focus on San Onofre and the use of thin-walled storage canisters, only 5/8 of an inch of stainless steel, held only 100 feet from the Pacific Ocean to store the so-called spent fuel rods, all of which contain plutonium. Charles Langley and Nina Babiars of Public Watchdogs talk about legal action taken by their group and bring us up to date on where we stand with San Onofre's nuclear waste legacy.
What is going on at San Onofre and what actions has Public Watchdogs been taking?
After an 11-and-a-half-month work stoppage that happened on August 3 when they nearly dropped a canister of nuclear waste weighing 100,000 pounds, the NRC finally allowed Edison to resume burial. So right now they've loaded, I believe, 33 or 34 of the ultimately 73 canisters that'll be entombed 108 feet away from the beach. Public Watchdogs has filed for an emergency restraining order to stop the burial of that nuclear waste immediately on the grounds that the canister system that they are using is unsafe. In addition, we got a news report that showed up in the San Diego Union-Tribune on Sunday showing that an inspector at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the NRC, actually said, hey, every can that's gone into the ground has been damaged, and this does not comply with the permits that the NRC issued allowing the owner of this nuclear waste, Southern California Edison, to bury the waste on the beach. So there's a bit of a stink about that right now, and we're waiting to see what the NRC is going to do because it looks like they've tried to cover this up or gloss it over.
Well, I'd just like to add that in addition to suing the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, our filing also includes Southern California Edison, the parent company Sempra, SDG&E, which is San Diego Gas and Electric, that also has a small portion of San Onofre, as well as Holtec International. And so it's all inclusive. We didn't leave anybody out of the party.
What force or what power does this kind of a filing have, or what is the potential? Or is it possible that it will just be ignored, glossed over, and they'll continue loading these faulty, damaged canisters?
Well, I want to clarify, there's actually two separate filings. There's a filing of what Charles described as a temporary restraining order, referred to as a TRO, to stop the burial now until the safety of the burial can be addressed. And then there's also a filing of our full complaint, a legal complaint, which details in great detail exactly why this burial is unsafe and how each party plays in that unsafe burial.
What in the world is the justification, if any, that the NRC has given for the continuation of the burial of the waste in these canisters, given that even their own people on the inside are saying there's damage, there are problems here, beyond which we have the community in an uproar and the number of challenges that people have made to this system?
Well, their justification is a continued pattern of behavior, and that pattern of behavior is not one of a regulator. They're constantly now lacing in the word oversight, oversight. Well, you know, we're asking them to regulate. We're asking the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to do their job, and their job is to enforce federal laws that were passed to protect the public's safety. And so when you have a regulator that's looking the other way, it's just not acceptable in a case like this where public safety is at risk.
Libby, their justification is that these are minor scratches, dings, and gouges on the canisters, and that it's going to corrode over and self-heal the stainless steel container. Now, and the problem with these containers is they weigh about 100,000 pounds. Each one includes 37 spent fuel assemblies, and they're made out of 5/8-inch thick stainless steel. So it's like a gigantic soup can filled with deadly nuclear waste. And our concern is that even though stainless steel doesn't rust, if it's nicked or cut or scratched in a corrosive marine environment, which it is at San Onofre, it's about 108 feet from the Pacific Ocean in these concrete silos, and the salt water and salt mist can get in there, that if there's any trace of salt in the air, it can create this situation where you get cracking, called chloride-induced, salt-induced stress corrosion cracking. And that has happened at the Cobourg nuclear facility, which is also located near the ocean, in water tanks that are also located about the same distance from salt water. So we're very concerned about the possibility of these canisters cracking open. And if they do crack open, they'll release millions of curies of radiation, and they'll also be impossible to move, because the only way they can get them out of the holes in the ground is to hook a winch up to the top and lift them up. Well, if you've got a cracked canister, even if it's a microscopic crack, that kind of stress could potentially break them open.
I want to make sure your listeners have some very recent information as well, and that's the NRC came out to California August the 20th to fulfill a quote-unquote commitment to the community, and part of that commitment was to give an update as to what has transpired at San Onofre since the resumption of the burial. I found it personally very disturbing that the gentleman that was giving this presentation outlined some significant quote-unquote issues that have transpired since the resumption of the burial that resulted in, number one, an employee walking under the downloading process that shut down the downloading of a canister once again. And that was termed by the NRC as an industrial safety incident. And that industrial safety incident shut that downloading down for several hours, at which point Edison employees took it upon themselves to ventilate the can that was in the downloading process, not in accordance with San Onofre procedures, but a procedure that they witnessed at a completely different nuclear waste decommissioning site. And so here you've got just another incident of the NRC retroactively looking the other way after these violations occur, and instead of calling them out for what that they are, is, again, improper training by the employee who walked under the downloading process, improper training by the employee of applying a procedure from another site to San Onofre, and, of course, we've had management issues that obviously haven't been corrected, or an industrial safety accident wouldn't have occurred. So, you know, with the NRC oversight, that to us equates one thing, Levy, and that's a look in the other way, or an enforcement policy that's basically known by the rest of the world as CYA.
You know, the thing about the word oversight, and you touched upon it, is that it has two equally valid meanings that are totally opposite. One of them is overseeing as in managing, and the other one is overlooking as in turning the blind eye. And it seems like the latter is the one that the NRC is following, because these problems are endless and progressive. It seems that not a week goes by when they're in operation that there isn't some new problem that comes to light, no matter how much the NRC or Southern California Edison tries to damp it down, which is a problem in and of itself.
I pointed out at this meeting that, you know, unless somebody's changed it recently, I believe that it is the NRC, not the NOC. You know, we're just asking them to fulfill their mission of regulating an industry. And obviously, if they have a problem in doing that, it might just be a clear demonstration that they're a captured agency, and then there needs to be more than just oversight involved with regard to the NRC.
They're turning a blind eye to serious safety issues at this facility, and we expect that to continue.
Is there anything else that we can do, that the listeners can do, to try and support some regulatory sanity at San Onofre?
Get involved. Get engaged on our website at publicwatchdogs.org. Sign our petition. We'll keep you in the loop in terms of developments of what's going on at San Onofre. But until we get a government order from a federal court saying you can't move this nuclear waste, we are going to continue to see horrific safety problems at San Onofre.
Charles Langley and Nina Babiarz of the Southern California San Onofre Group, Public Watchdogs. We'll continue with this week's nuclear update feature in just a moment. But first, my birthday is on Sunday, September 29. And it's a landmark that ends in a zero and starts with a, let's just say I've already been eligible for Social Security for a lot of years and leave it at that. I love that one of the best presents I could have received is the shutdown of my personal nemesis, Three Mile Island, and a big woohoo to that. So if you'd like to celebrate this birthday with me and honor my decades of life and activism, there's another way to go, and that's to send in a donation in support of Nuclear Hot Seat. You know that you depend on Nuclear Hot Seat as the gift of information that keeps on giving all year long. Facts and nuclear industry manipulation, attitude, actions you can take, and just some commiseration that you're not alone with your perceptions and fears about nuclear. Yes, it's true that we are all in the nuclear hot seat, and the best defense against it is to know exactly what's going on and how to resist its spread. So I'm rededicating myself to moving into yet another new decade of life with Nuclear Hot Seat as my vehicle. To do that, I need your help to get us together and throw a no nukes party as I continue in the ninth year of sharing with you interviews with activists and genuine experts who contradict the state-approved narrative, along with a roundup of international news, numbnuts of the week, and anything else I can manage to squeeze into the hour. Where else can you find all this in a weekly counterbalance to nuclear industry propaganda lies? So come on, it's easy to donate. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the big red donate button to send a one-time donation or set up a monthly donation of any size. And to send us a monthly $5, the same as you would spend on a cup of coffee with a tip here in the U.S., just click on the big green donate button at nuclearhotseat.com. Please do what you can now, and know whatever you do to help, I'm not only deeply grateful that you're listening, but that you care. Now, back to this week's special update on the nuclear fuel chain through the eyes of activists on the ground. Activism against nuclear weapons is again building up to take on the buildup of nuclear weapons. One extremely active group is the Washington State Physicians for Social Responsibility. To find out more about what grassroots activism is happening in that state, I talked with Carly Brook, WPSR's nuclear weapons abolition organizer, and she had a lot to tell us.
WPSR, since the Cold War, has had an active role in the nuclear disarmament movement. We started out when citizen physicians started exchanges with the Soviet Union physicians at the time in order to create diplomacy at a citizen level to de-escalate the Cold War. And folks were very active in the struggle against nuclear weapons during the 80s, when the total number of nuclear weapons at the peak of the Cold War reached about 70,000 worldwide, just between the two countries. And since that time has been brought down to around 15,000. So we're concerned about the dangers associated with both the production of nuclear material, the risk of accidents, the legacies of testing, and also, of course, the risk of actual nuclear conflict between any of the 9 nuclear armed nations. So we focus on this issue because the level of damage created by even one nuclear explosion, let alone the chain of reactions that would create a full-scale nuclear war, is just beyond belief and beyond the point where even physicians or medical providers would be able to treat the level of health effects.
The entire subject of nuclear weapons, nuclear war, the aftermath of radiation and the contamination that comes from it is such a huge topic. It's difficult for people to wrap their brains around it, and it's difficult to know which way to go. How does WPSR, how do you suggest that people become involved in pushing back against this growing nuclear arms race that we suddenly find ourselves back in?
That's a great point, because we really do see ourselves at the starting line of a new nuclear arms race, whether that is the breakdown of treaties like the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty that helped to end the Cold War by banning short-range missiles. That treaty just expired August 2nd. And in the days following that treaty, there were 2 incidents. One was a nuclear explosion in northern Russia, which was identified to be a new type of weapon that they were testing. And in the week following that, the second incident was the United States testing the intermediate range nuclear missile that had formerly been banned by the treaty. So we're seeing this buildup again of arms. And it can be a really intimidating issue for people to take on and people to find an entry point. So one of the ways that we try to have people connect with this issue is just even inside of Washington State, understanding our personal connections. So one of the sites that's critical for people in the state to know about is the naval base at Kitsap Bangor, which originally served as the U.S. Navy Ammunition Depot, responsible for shipping conventional weapons abroad. But this base hosts 8 submarines that have 20 Trident missiles on each submarine, with 8 warheads on each missile, with a total capacity of 1,280 nuclear explosives. This site is located just 20 miles from Seattle, which a lot of people don't know. So even just getting the information out there that if Washington State was its own country, it would be one of the largest nuclear powers in the world, given the number of nuclear weapons hosted here inside our state borders. So people understanding that this really puts us on the map in terms of potential targets of nuclear attack, but also gives us an increased responsibility to take action. And happy to talk a little bit more about how it is that we organize on this issue as well.
Please do take the lead on that.
Over the last 2 years, we've developed a grassroots coalition of different community partners called Washington Against Nuclear Weapons. And what we found was when we were lobbying in Congress to reduce nuclear weapons funding, to stop the nuclear weapons modernization or to prevent particular new weapons from being deployed, we weren't a powerful enough force on our own. And so we started organizing and identifying key civil society organizations, whether it be in the labor sector, youth organizations, faith groups, peace and justice organizations, to unite under a single coalition to coordinate our efforts. And now we've grown to nearly 45 organizations statewide, where we are able to coordinate our lobby work, coordinate our grassroots organizing, and take collective action on this issue. And one of the ways that we're partnering together is an upcoming event called the People's Town Hall on Nuclear Weapons. And this event aims to expose the many connections and many people impacted in different ways by nuclear weapons in Washington State. So we'll have folks coming out to represent the Spokane tribe, whose land hosts the Midnight Mine, where some of the uranium was mined for the bombings on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the people there are still dealing with the health impacts of that cleanup site. We'll also have people representing survivors of the attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki through the Seattle Hiroshima Club, addressing the impacts of radiation and loss of life under nuclear attack and complete destruction of both infrastructure and environment, and of course, communities. We'll also have speakers representing the Marshall Islands, where 67 nuclear weapons were tested during the Cold War on their lands, in the ocean off the shores of their lands, forcing many people to migrate into places like Washington State. So we're able to come together to draw these connections and make a concerted argument together that nuclear weapons are not safe, they're too expensive, and we need to be creating an international norm to move in the opposite direction.
You know, these are all excellent moves, and I would hope that next week's conference is going to be at least recorded, if not live streamed, so that people outside of Washington State can be able to participate or at least gain the information. Is that going to be the case?
Yes, we'll have a live stream on our Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility Facebook, and we're hosting it at Town Hall Seattle, and Town Hall will also produce a podcast recording of the event.
We've known, at least the sane people among us have known for a long time, that nuclear bombs are bad, nuclear war is bad. There's no winning a nuclear war because the entire planet and all life on it will suffer by the radiation that follows beyond any initial attack. What is different now, if anything, that gives us the hope that we will be able to make some progress and dial back the rhetoric, the actions, the growing threat that somebody is going to think somewhere that it's a good idea to use a nuclear bomb?
That's a great question. One of the things that's different now is for the first time since the Cold War, we're actually seeing movement in Congress on this issue. Chairman Adam Smith, who is the chair of the House Armed Services Committee, is really leading a conversation in Congress about the role of nuclear weapons and our nuclear weapons posture. Some of the key issues that he's raising, along with other colleagues, is an issue called No First Use. And this addresses the U.S. role as the only nation that has ever started a nuclear war with the first strike. And so they're trying to pass a policy that would prevent the United States from ever starting a nuclear war or using nuclear weapons first. This would be a major victory because we really want to see nuclear weapons taken off the table in terms of military action because of their level of destruction. We're also seeing more and more people in Congress come on board to talk about the risk of a new type of weapon called low-yield nuclear explosives. And these weapons are about a third the size of the bomb dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But these weapons are particularly dangerous as quote-unquote small nukes because they change the balance and calculation of nuclear weapons use. And unfortunately, some politicians are talking about them as usable nuclear weapons. So they really blur the lines of conventional war and nuclear war, with the possibility that one of these types of weapons might be deployed. So there's a fight right now to make sure that, since these weapons haven't arrived, haven't been deployed yet, that we could still stop them in Congress. And there's a pretty active conversation about that right now in the National Defense Authorization Act, whether or not that funding will be approved.
We actually had a conversation 3 weeks ago on Nuclear Hot Seat number 428 with Jay Coughlin of NukeWatch New Mexico, and he went into great detail about the actual dangers of a small nuke being launched because somebody thought that, hey, it's small, nobody will really notice that it's a nuke, and whatever country is receiving it not being able to determine the size of the bomb coming in. They just know a bomb's coming in or that a bomb has landed, and they will retaliate full force, and there we will have it.
It's a huge danger, and it's something not to be taken lightly. And we actually have the opportunity right now to make sure that the funding for these weapons to be deployed is not approved between now and the end of the NDAA conference.
So what can an individual do who wishes to join in this very worthwhile Let's Stop the Bomb program and have a voice that is heard and that has the potential to join with others to make a genuine difference?
There's a lot that individuals can do. One of the ways that people can have an impact on this issue is to actually make your voice heard with your representative in Congress. While so many issues are so worthy of our time and attention, this is not an issue that our representatives are hearing about from their constituents the same way that they were back in the 80s. And while this issue has sort of faded to the back of mind for many people, the current rising tensions globally, whether it be between Israel and Iran, India and Pakistan, the United States and Russia, are calling for a broader movement against nuclear weapons. And so one of the ways that you can make your voice heard is by contacting your member of Congress to ask that they co-sponsor a no first use policy or co-sponsor the Hold the Line Act, which addresses that low yield nuclear weapons issue we were just talking about. So that's one way. Another way is to use some of the resources that we've developed with Washington Against Nuclear Weapons to inform people in your community, to host an informational session or share information so that people are more informed about these types of issues with nuclear weapons.
And if people wish to contact you and WPSR, Washington State Physicians for Social Responsibility, to gain this information or perhaps just do a brain-busting session with each other to figure out what is possible in their area, how can they reach out and what's the best way to get to you?
We have a lot of good information on our website, which is WPSR.org, or our coalition website, WANWcoalition.org, where you can go in depth on the history of nuclear weapons in Washington or take note of our calls to action. And you can also contact us directly via our phone at 206-547-2630. And we're more than happy to build and continue to grow both the statewide and national movement against nuclear weapons.
That was Carly Brook, nuclear weapons abolition organizer for Washington State Physicians for Social Responsibility. Finally, we look at the start of the nuclear fuel chain, uranium mining, and its continued impact on northern Saskatchewan. Candace Paul is a member of the English River First Nations and works with the Committee for Future Generations. She and her people live a traditional lifestyle close to the land, which is why you will hear moose mentioned more than once.
Candace Paul, it's great to have you with us here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you. It's glad to be back.
What has been the history in northern Saskatchewan regarding uranium mining and other issues?
Saskatchewan has long history of uranium mining, over 60, almost 70 years now. On the far north, around Uranium City, they were involved in getting material for the Cold War for the United States and other allies, I guess, probably England and France as well. And since then, there has been a lot of uranium mining in our part of northern Saskatchewan. It's called the Athabasca Basin. It's all Denisoklina territory. All our hunting territory is, unfortunately, got rich deposits of uranium ore. So that's the history in a nutshell. We have probably 40 or more abandoned uranium mines, some in various states of clean up or not cleaned up. The Gunner mine is in the process of being cleaned up, and it was one of the bigger, messier spots. Laredo mine is ready to get turned over to institutional control. Whether it's actually really cleaned up to a satisfactory degree is really doubtful. They can't clean the contamination that ended up in the lake, and that's a big lake that flows all the way to the Mackenzie River, so it's contaminating chunks of the planet already. The tailings from those mines were flowing through the rain, through the snow melts, through the wind for decades before anything was ever done. There is now another decommissioned mine. It's almost ready for being basically abandoned. It's the Clough Lake mine, which operated from the 70s to about 1980-something. And they say it's world's best practice in decommissioning uranium mines. But we've got whistleblowers coming out telling us what they didn't do and the shortcuts they took and the things that could be causing problems. They've actually gone back and looked at the sites themselves, these workers, and they're not happy. And they're feeling pretty crappy about the job that they were made to do. And yet the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission and the province of Saskatchewan say it's good enough. There's no real oversight. They say it'll be all right for traditional use, except one of these guys actually tracked a moose right into where the tailings had been and into the water. There's cattails and things there now. And they were pawing through to get to the salty contaminated stuff. There's only 1 meter, that's 3 feet, of cover, rock, sand, soil on top of it, and the moose have been pawing through to get to the salty stuff underneath. A lot of runoff comes onto it, so there's water pooled there. He tracked that moose, he hunted that moose, and he killed it, and when he opened it up, he noticed right away the liver was bad. And for us as a people, we know we don't eat a sick moose. And a bad liver designates a sick moose. He said it smelled bad, it looked bad, it tasted bad. I don't know why he tasted it, but he did. So he decided to take samples, tissue samples from all of the organs, the bones, and meat, and sent them off to Saskatchewan Research Council, which is supposed to be an independent lab that would test these things. And the results came back, and he sent me the results. He was concerned with the high levels of cadmium in the meat. I sent these results to the lab in Le Havre, CRIRAD, and they sent back immediately, don't let anybody eat that meat. Look at the polonium levels. They've used a different unit so that it looks small, but it's not. It's high. And he recorded a whole conversation between him and the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, the Saskatchewan government, Saskatchewan Health, and he tried to take them to task over that moose and the contamination of that moose. And they really scrambled. They were desperate. Because he spread that news across the north to all the people that depend on, we depend a lot on moose for our sustenance up here. People were very, very concerned. They scrambled. They said, well, you know, those cadmium levels, you must be comparing them to the, you know, what's acceptable in the Yukon. That's kind of weird, because if it's not safe in the Yukon, how is it safe here?
And that is from the general contamination that came from mining throughout Saskatchewan?
Well, around the Clough Lake mine, the one that's being decommissioned. Now, we've got 5 mines that are currently status of mine. Although 4 of them right now, since the downturn in the uranium market, are on just shutdown operations and maintenance. although the Rabbit Lake mine is probably going to get closed because it was nearing being mined out anyway. So we've got the MacArthur River mine, Cigar Lake mine. Cigar Lake's the one that's operating, Rabbit Lake mine, Key Lake, which is no longer a mine, but the mill is still operating, and McLean Lake mine and mill.
I recently covered the uranium tailing spill from 40 years ago that happened at Church Rock on Navajo Nation. I understand that you also had a significant uranium spill up in Saskatchewan. Tell me about that.
We had one in 1984, and it got in. They released a lot of liters. I'm not even sure how much of contaminated tailings water got into the river systems, into the watershed. So the Haltane River was impacted. It's probably still impacted to this day. There's been multiple spills. Not everything ever made the news. We didn't find out about one that happened in 2014 until there was a hearing on uranium processing plant that's in downtown Toronto. And one of our members of our committee went to that, and they were discussing a spill that had happened that week in our territory at the Key Lake facility. Nobody in Saskatchewan knew about it. They listed on their website, but you have to know when and where to look. And that's an issue. And it's still an issue. Just last June, they discovered that the mill has been in operations maintenance now for 2 years. And they discovered a leak of uranium into the groundwater. It had seeped through the floor of the molybdenum extraction plant, which is one of the most toxic places in the milling system. It had basically, uranium had contaminated the floor because the caustic materials they used to process it ate through the surface of the floor. So the floor is relatively thick concrete. They apparently replaced the top surface of that floor in 2012 and sealed it again. But since then, it has eaten through again. They had put water on top of the floor because they knew there was uranium in there, and it was releasing radon gas at all times, but because there wasn't constant use for just checking it once a month or however often they check it, they put water on the floor so they wouldn't have to dress people up in hazmat suit to check. And lo and behold, they check and there's no water on that floor.
Meaning that the water had soaked through, which means that any kind of contamination that would have been there would also have soaked through.
Exactly. And then they checked some test wells around the building, and it had gone at least 20 meters into the groundwater below the building, away from the building. This is in our territory. This is in our English River territory, of which I'm a band member. And our band membership wanted a lot more information about this because it's very concerning for our people. Still have a cultural camp 60 kilometers from that mine site. They hunt moose in that area still. They wanted to know, like, what are they going to do about it? We had a big meeting at our band with the CNSC and Cameco. Basically, they don't know what to do. They've sent it to Golder Associates for computer modeling to try and figure out what to do. They claim it's very slow moving, but it only took 6 months for it to go that far. So for us, that's not that slow moving. In 20, 30 years after decommissioning that place, we will still be around. Our people will still be using that territory. So really, we're still sitting here waiting for answers. We only learned about the contamination of that floor because we happened to ask the right question. They told us about that resurfacing that had happened in 2012, which means it had been doing this for years. And a lot of the farmer mill workers knew this, and they knew the company knew it. But they went the cheap route and only replaced the surface. So I asked the Nuclear Safety Commission, how do you guys regulate the building materials that are used? Because concrete is basically porous. Water does go through it. Well, we don't regulate the building materials, he says. That's up to Canada Building Codes. Canada Building Codes are bare minimum set of codes. So I'm really not impressed with the lack of responsibility and accountability on that. Mm-hmm. With both the company, who was obviously just taking shortcuts, and the regulator, who has never bothered to deal with material. And that makes me very concerned, because do they deal with material with nuclear reactors?
It sounds like the government and the uranium mining companies are trying to get away with the lowest possible standards they can. And as a result, there's been contamination, certainly in the waterways in Saskatchewan, and it sounds like in the food supply as well. What kind of pushback or fight back is coming from you and the other residents of the English River Band?
Pushback is getting greater from the band membership, maybe not so much the administration, because they are tied to the industry through a collaboration agreement. It was a 10-year agreement. For another 4 years, they got to keep saying nice stuff about Cameco and Areva. But the membership, we're not very pleased, and we're demanding a lot more accountability. And they were actually demanding daily monitoring of these wells, because there apparently used to be daily monitoring, and wondered why that isn't proceeding. And they also were demanding that the CNSC do not consider any further licenses until these things are accounted for and these things are rectified. So that kind of pushback is what's happening. We made that information as public as possible through Facebook. Media picked it up. So because media picked it up, the rest of Saskatchewan got to hear about it, because the rest of Saskatchewan has no idea what goes on up here in these mines. Nothing. They don't know about the contamination. I run a whistleblower's hotline, and some of the mill operators, because nobody's working anymore, they've all been permanently laid off now, and they are starting to talk. They told me, like, there's safety systems within the mill, okay, and they're supposed to, alarms are supposed to detect when filters are full that need changing. Well, they've learned to bypass, though. Cameco tells them, bypass it, we don't want to stop production right now. So when the socks are full, they just bypass it. The socks are the filters. They bypass it, and all of that is vented out into the environment, into the air. And people who are expected to clean the calcinators where the yellow cake is separated and spun out, those guys only wear those little white disposable coveralls, and for years were only wearing carpenter's masks to work in that and spray them out and clean them. And they all have been contaminated. Many of them have died. And now they contract that work out, and those guys come in with full hazmat suits. Things that have been dumped into the tailings as well, people in Saskatchewan knew nothing about. There's a whole locomotive and train, cars, track, and all of the equipment that was used to haul it from North Dakota. There was an accident where a train hit a yellow cake truck. And all of that stuff, including all of the topsoil for a mile around, was all brought back to Key Lake and dumped in the tailings pit.
So, in other words, they, quote-unquote, decontaminated the site of the accident and just took all that contamination and dumped it in the middle of the lake in your area.
Yeah, that's what they did. And we didn't. Nobody in Saskatchewan was aware of that, except maybe a few of the people that worked up there. Those are the people that informed us of it. That was back in 1984. Southern Saskatchewan, where most of the population live, they haven't got a clue. They think uranium mining is fine because it brings in jobs, and they hear that the native people up north are employed. Well, it was a big employer, yes, but a lot of the people that worked were given the dirtiest jobs. They weren't given the safest jobs. They were given the grunt jobs, and they were told to put out and shut up or get blacklisted, and that happened all the time. Now they're talking.
This is an ongoing outrage that you have been dealing with, and it doesn't sound like it's going to end anytime soon. What can those of us who perhaps don't live in Saskatchewan, even southern Saskatchewan, but elsewhere in the world, but are hearing this report, what can we do to support you?
Right now, because of that downturn, there is no real market for uranium, and we don't want to ever see a new market for uranium. But U.S. and Canada are in cahoots to promote small modular nuclear reactors. in Canada, the Natural Resources Canada is promoting them for use in northern communities, northern indigenous communities, where they say they want to reduce greenhouse gases because diesel is used to generate electricity in some of these very remote communities. We also have big climate change issues like permafrost melting and sinkholes and all of that. The Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission has asked the government not to require environmental impact assessments on the deployment of small modular nuclear reactors. A lot of these reactors will not really be for those communities. They will really be for resource extraction, which is, they've basically sold out northern Canada for resources. It's devastating in terms of what we can expect in the future. So small modular reactors will be nuclear waste all over the country. They're all experimental. So if people could just do whatever they can to stop this nonsense of greenwashing small modular nuclear reactors, SMRs, they like to call them, they like to leave out the nuclear word, that would be really helpful because that will kill their industry. As we are living right now, there's still uranium exploration happening. There's two junior companies trying for a license for uranium mines, one who wants to do in situ leach mining. Yeah, there's no problem on the surface. It's all in the aquifers.
That's one of the things that's being fought against so desperately in Navajo Nation, because that's the next generation of mining that the mining companies want to bring in.
It's basically fracking for uranium. And what this company is already doing, and I don't know how the heck they got a permit to do it, because I've never seen the permit. They are putting solution in already to check if it will break down the ore enough to make it viable, which means they're already contaminating those aquifers, and they're already contaminating and fracturing the ground. And like northern Saskatchewan is basically a big sponge. It's water, muskegs. Muskegs are like peat bogs. It's just a big water, and like fresh, the world's freshest water at one point anyway. Contaminating all that water for their industry is a crime. It's just a crime. So we have huge concerns regarding health issues for our people, our wildlife, for them too. So for people to help out, fight that small modular reactor nonsense, please.
That was Candace Paul, a member of the English River First Nations, who works with the Committee for Future Generations. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, September 24, 2019. Thanks to all of you for caring and for listening and joining with Nuclear Hot Seat listeners and followers around the world. We are in 123 countries on 6 continents and growing. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered by email every week, it is easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down for the yellow box, and sign up for a weekly email link to the latest show. I won't bug you, you'll just get the one. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment to send a donation of any size to nuclearhotseat.com. Or if you just want to celebrate my 70th birthday, oops, it got out, didn't it? You can send a donation as well, and we will really appreciate the support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2019, Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as proper attribution is provided. This is Libby Halevi of Hardestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that the last thing anyone who opposes nuclear wants to be able to say is, "I told you so." There you have it. You have just had your nuclear wake-up call. Now don't go back to sleep, because truly, we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Question everything. Intelligent radio for intelligent people. UCY.TV.
is Ozzy Skateboard, and you're listening to UCRI.TV.
I have seen the torch of freedom pass from hand to yearning hand.